Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. I'm Grant Reher. My guest today is Ezra Levin, a co-founder of the group Indivisible, a movement that formed in the immediate aftermath of the 2016 elections to resist the anticipated policy changes a Donald Trump presidency was expected to bring. Since then, it has proved to be a vibrant and sustained political force for progressive candidates and causes more generally. And now, Ezra is the co-author of a new book titled We Are Indivisible, A Blueprint for Democracy After Trump. Prior to co-founding Indivisible, Ezra worked for the nonprofit organization Prosperity Now, and prior to that, he was a congressional staffer. In 2019, he was named to Time's list of the most influential people. Ezra, welcome to the program, and congratulations for making that list.
Great to be here.
So let's just start with the beginnings. Could you briefly relate the history of this movement or organization? Maybe it's important to distinguish which one of those it's best thought of. And then, so why and when did it start? How did it grow? You know, just give me the basics.
Yeah, so it's as much a surprise to me as it is to anybody, honestly. I'm a former congressional staffer, as you mentioned, as was my spouse, Leah Greenberg. After the 2016 election, we were going through the stages of grief just like any other progressive, like we were seeing our friends and family. And as dark as that time was immediately after the election, looking forward to what 2017 could be, there was this silver lining. And the silver lining was we were getting contacted by friends and family members who had never been politically active before, but were trying to wrap their arms around this question of, what do I do now? How can I be part of the solution? I feel powerless. And, you know, as former congressional staffers, Lee and I, we don't have very many applicable skills, but we know how Congress works. And so we thought what we could do was take the lessons that we had learned being Capitol Hill staffers and demystify Congress for people around the country and say, no, you actually do have power. And we drew on a specific source of knowledge, which was when we were Capitol Hill staffers, the Tea Party was coming into existence. Now, we worked for progressives. We disagreed with the Tea Party's ideology, their racism, their sometimes violence. But we thought they were very smart on strategies and tactics. They looked at the political situation. They didn't have the House. They didn't have the Senate. They didn't have the presidency. But they had legitimacy because they were constituents. So they focused in on their two senators, their one representative, and they played defense. And we wrote this guide, the Indivisible Guide, to say, that's a smart set of strategies and tactics. You can build power yourself, even though progressives lack the House, lack the Senate, lack the presidency. You can affect political change before the next election. You can affect it right now. You just got to organize locally. So we put together this guide. We tweeted it out to, you know, a few dozen followers on Twitter. And shockingly, people read it. And even more shockingly, they started forming Indivisible groups all over the country.
So you said they play defense. And so you were taking that part of the playbook out. Say more about what play defense means in your playbook.
I remember within a week or two after the election, really the time when we set down this road for writing the Indivisible Guide is clear in my mind because there were two events within 24 hours of each other. One was that a future Trump appointee was speaking about the Japanese internment camps during World War II as an example of what we could do with the Muslim population. And that was roughly the same as they were talking about refugees and immigrants broadly. Within 24 hours of that, there was also an interview in the New York Times with incoming minority leader Chuck Schumer, in which he was describing the new political environment. And the basic message was, look, Democrats lost the election. That's how things go. We're just going to have to find a way to work with the other side. Maybe we can work together and produce bipartisan legislation on infrastructure. So we were looking forward to the future of 2017, and it was a future. It's a bipartisan future and one in which the roads being paved on the way to America's new internment camps were really smooth and clear. And that was terrifying to us. And so when we were putting out the guide, we said, no. Actually, that doesn't have to be our approach right now. Actually, we can recognize the assault coming on our values, coming on the horizon, and we can say no. We can play defense. We don't have agenda-setting power because we don't have the House, the Senate, or the presidency, but because we are constituents, because our representatives have to represent us ultimately or lose re-election, we can demand that. So let's not go to the other side and work on internment camp infrastructure packages. Let's say no to that agenda. And then let's build up our power as we head into the next election.
So you said you were caught you by surprise, and give me a sense of just how quickly and widely this grew. Do you have some basic statistics there?
Well, it was shocking. Like I said, we tweeted it out to my couple dozen of followers. We were eating soup at the kitchen table.
That's the way that always goes, that story. We were doing something completely unrelated to this.
Frankly, we had been working on the Google document for about 3 weeks, and it had been consuming our lives. We could just eat, breathe, and sleep, indivisible. That's all we were talking about, and we were like, okay, we've got to move on. Let's tweet it out. Hopefully it's useful. Hopefully somebody sometime in the future goes to a congressional town hall, asks a question of the representative, and they report back to us, and that would have been success. Instead, we tweeted it out, and within minutes, if not maybe a couple hours, the Google Doc crashed in mid-December of 2016 because so many people were trying to access it. People then couldn't download it or print it, so we got these thousands of emails in saying, I can't download the document, I can't print it. And the other very common email we got was, this guide is full of typos. Because if you want, let me tell you, if you want a document copy edited, the best way to do it is put it online, have it go viral. You will have a lot of very helpful copy editors come out of the woodwork. But so the response was immediate. And so the first response was it going viral. It's a document that goes viral. And that happens, you know, pretty regularly. They're not with political manifestos. You know, when you put your thoughts about how to save American democracy online, you don't expect that many people to read it. But other types of media go viral all the time. And I don't think that's actually the most impressive part of Indivisible because it's a relatively common event. I think the impressive part is that people not only opened it, people not only read it, but they started forming Indivisible groups. So after the typo emails, after the response is about I can't download or print it, people started sending us emails saying, I'm with a group of my friends. We didn't know what to do, but now we're Indivisible East Tennessee, or we're Indivisible Albuquerque, or we're Indivisible Houston. Within days, there were hundreds of those groups registering with us. By January 2017, there were literally thousands of locally led Indivisible groups all around the country, not just in blue states, not just in city centers, but literally in every single congressional district in the country. Mm. And that remains the same today.
Hmm. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with Ezra Levin, a co-founder of the Indivisible Movement. So then let's talk about how your organization operates, who it's playing defense with. And first of all, is it formally aligned with the Democratic Party in any way?
Yeah, affirmatively, we are not aligned with the Democratic Party. We affirmatively say we are not an arm of the Democratic Party. And in fact, I think there is a rich history of social movements existing alongside but outside of the formal party structure. Half of the purpose of Indivisible is to ensure that not just to put pressure on Republicans who are backing Trump with and using a rubber stamp for all of his proposals, but it's also to ensure that Democrats stand up and fight for our values, which means sometimes we're working hand in glove with our allies on Capitol Hill who are in the Democratic Party, and sometimes we're not. Sometimes we're pushing them to do more. Organizationally, though, you know, Indivisible started as an organization just as dozens and then hundreds of volunteers working out of our living room and other living rooms. That's what we were doing. What became clear pretty early on, sometime in January, was that that just wasn't sustainable. If you had seen our living room in January 2017, you would have seen a lot of LaCroix cans spewed across the table and Leah and I sitting on the couch in a really disheveled mess. And that was true for a lot of the volunteers early on who were working nights and weekends and skipping days at work just so that they could help respond to all this incoming coming from this burgeoning movement. So we ended up setting up a national organization. And today that is a national nonprofit. We have coming up on 90 full-time staff spread around the country who are working fundamentally, not for a specific policy issue, not for a specific candidate, but with the idea that if you have a locally built up power base that is building progressive power, from that is going to flow your electoral victories, from that is going to flow your progressive policy victories. So the reason why a national organization exists to support this national movement is to strengthen these groups.
And just for the record, I assume then that none of the local groups have ever acted on to support a Republican candidate.
So I actually think it's somewhat more complex than that.
Okay.
So the indivisible groups are made up of people who are Democrats, who are independents, who are Republicans or former Republicans. Some of the really valuable activities that indivisible groups will engage in is providing not just accountability for Republicans or independents or Democrats that are acting poorly, but providing positive reinforcement when they're acting well, acting in the right way. So we see examples of this, for instance, when John McCain votes to beat back Donald Trump's attempt to repeal the Affordable Care Act, indivisible groups and other groups lined the driveway leading up to his house with thank you notes.
Okay.
And that's part of it. We need to be welcoming of folks who are willing to come out to our side. One thing that I think about is I'm from the South. I grew up in the boonies in Texas. And, of course, there are big mega churches all over the South. And a story I think about is those mega churches, or at least some of them, reserve parking at the very front of the church for folks who have never been before. The idea is you want to be as welcoming as possible to newcomers. Movements are either growing or shrinking. Those are the two options. And in order for Indivisible to sustain itself, we can't treat newcomers as the enemy. We have to treat newcomers as friends and welcome them into the movement. So even if somebody is a temporary ally and just fighting with us for this particular fight, I want them on our side, and indivisible groups want them on our side now too.
So let me just probe that a little bit deeper then, and more specifically. The tactics of the groups include then, and the part of this sort of, I think, playing defense that you were mentioning before, a significant amount of what is essentially like riding of local Republican members of Congress. Both sides you do this on, but
yeah.
I think in particular Republican members of Congress, and filling town halls, going to their offices, requesting or demanding meetings. But some of those Republican members were not supportive of Trump as a candidate. So the example here would be our member of Congress from Syracuse, John Katko, would be in that category. But he still got the same treatment from the indivisible groups. So I'm trying to tease out kind of where the line is for when you sort of push in a way that says, hey, look, you know, we're not happy here, or we're going to make this life, we're going to make your life difficult, versus we, you know, we want you to vote no on the reform of the or the change of the ACA. How do you, help me understand that line better. Is that question making sense?
It makes sense. One thing I would say is talk is cheap. And look, as a former congressional staffer, I can tell you there's nothing members of Congress like more than talk. They like strategic ambiguity. They like to say the right thing, make their constituents feel like they are one of the good people in Congress, but ultimately not back up that talk with action. I think Katko is a great example of that. He acts as if he is a quote-unquote moderate Republican, but in reality, he votes with Trump the overwhelming amount of the time. And so that's what we're looking at as a social movement. That's what indivisible groups are looking at. It matters what you say a little bit. It matters much more how you vote. It matters much more how you use your power. And so that applies to folks like Katko. It applies to folks like Chuck Schumer. It applies to anybody, regardless of what party you belong to. The fundamental idea at the heart of indivisible, which is somewhat radical, but it shouldn't be, is that in a representative democracy, your representatives ought to represent you. And that means you have now constituents who are organized in congressional districts, in states, looking at the representatives, seeing how they talk and seeing what they do, and then showing up and holding them accountable, either because they did the right thing to provide positive reinforcement or because they did the wrong thing. And these indivisible groups want their representatives to know, hey, we're watching you.
You're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm talking with Ezra Levin, the co-founder of the Indivisible Movement and co-author of a new book titled We Are Indivisible, A Blueprint for Democracy After Trump. So I do want to make sure we have enough time to get into your book, but I wanted to follow up on, again, what we were talking about right before the break and put this question to you. So I get what you're saying about the approach and the tactics, but one might come back and say the following. Okay, but then there are going to be a big chunk of people in some of these congressional districts that are not getting their voice being heard because they're not part of this organization. In other words, you are there, you show up, you're the loudest, and so you dominate the media coverage, and you know, and you are very skilled in doing all that because you are on the other side of it as a congressional staffer, so you've got that insight. So what do you say to the folks that in some of these districts might look at this and say, you know, they're not representing me? Is it just like, hey, you know, you got to get your own organization, or What do you do?
Organize.
Okay.
Organize. I mean, democracy is a participatory sport. The legitimacy that indivisible groups have doesn't come from the fact that you've got Ezra Levin and a national organization. It comes from the fact that they're constituents. Fundamentally, we just have to recognize that all legitimate political power in a real democracy comes from the people. In a representative democracy, the way we chunk out that power is we create districts. We create the ability to have representatives in Congress represent those people. So if you live in New York and you're listening to this and you don't like what I'm talking about, great. Organize your people. Mm. Organize them together and make your voice heard. There's nothing unique about indivisible other than there are groups of people leading themselves and building up power. And if you would like your voice heard, you got to organize too. Don't expect somebody else to do it for you.
My only worry, and we don't need to pursue this, is just in the climate that we're in now, two opposing organizations there meet in front of a town hall, bad stuff can happen. But, go ahead. You want to jump in on that?
Well, so I actually do think, although at a 30,000-foot level, indivisible looks somewhat similar to the early Tea Party of 2009, 2010, there are some key ways in which I think indivisible is very different. And one is that we are affirmatively nonviolent. We think, in fact, it hurts your legitimacy if you engage in any kind of violence, that the best thing that you can do is with conviction, but with conviction, but also understanding that you need to be both appearing reasonable and appearing as if you have the best interest of the constituency at heart. So if you show up screaming, if you show up throwing things, if you show up and engage in any kind of violence, that's going to undermine your position. I know I have had friends on Capitol Hill who were spat on by Tea Party members, who were in some way picked up or assaulted. That is bad because you shouldn't spit on people, but it's also tactically bad because it undermines your position. So I don't worry about indivisible groups coming in conflict with other groups on the ground who have different values, because I know indivisible groups believe that both their legitimacy comes from the fact that they show up with conviction, but they show up respectfully. And also it's core to how we think about our tactical advantage, that we need to be seen as legitimate constituents who want to be represented and not some sort of violent mob.
So let's talk about the book. You've got this new book out, just out, We Are Indivisible, A Blueprint for Democracy After Trump. And now this is more looking ahead from where we are now, in thinking maybe perhaps more about offense than defense. And it argues, among other things, for making some connections between structural changes in the political system and the achievement of the progressive policy goals that folks in your organization want to see. So tell me what the most important elements of the blueprint are.
Yeah, so what I would say is that for indivisible between 2017 and 2018, it very much was defined by defense. But social movements have to evolve, otherwise they will shrink. And we have to evolve with the times. And what we know now is in 2019 and headed into 2021, we're not just playing defense. We actually now have agenda-setting power. We have it because we took the House of Representatives, and we have it because we are now debating who the next president of the United States is going to be and what their agenda in 2021 is going to be. So reacting to that, Indivisible National started talking to indivisible groups all over the country. We polled them, we surveyed them, we did focus groups with them, asking them, what are your top priorities? What would you like to see the next president actually push forward? And the results were very clear. Indivisible groups, as you can imagine, care about just about everything under the sun. They care about immigration and healthcare and climate and taxes and you name it. But far above everything else, when you poll them, the number one priority is democracy itself. There is this fear that democracy itself is under threat. And we think that fear is well-founded. The problem is not just Trump. Trump is a grotesque, bile-spewing symptom from our point of view, but he is a symptom nonetheless of a much deeper problem, a much deeper sickness afflicting our country. And we need to tackle that problem. We need to not just defeat Trump, we need to defeat Trumpism. And that means correcting the flaws in our democracy to ensure that it truly does represent the will of the people. So this book is not just about the past. It takes lessons from the past, from the power building that's been going on these last 3 years in communities across the country. But we didn't want to just write about a history. We wanted to talk about the future, and not just in an analytical way. This book, yes, it's for indivisible group members, but it's even more for people who have been watching democracy crumble these past 3 years and wondering, what can I do? The book is intended to be a how-to guide for you. It's intended to tell you, this is how this works. This is where your power is, and this is what we can build in 2021 if we do everything we need to do. So whether you've never made a call in your life, whether you've never knocked on a door in your life, but you're watching the news, you're feeling something is wrong, and you're feeling paralyzed that everything is crashing and what is my role in this? The book is intended to empower you and tell you what you can actually do.
If you've just joined us, you're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. And my guest is Ezra Levin from the group Indivisible. So more specifically then, give me like one or two of the most important of these kind of structural changes that you'd like to see.
So I would say – I would think about the changes in two ways. One, it's the policy analysis. And I'm a policy nerd. You know, I was a Capitol Hill staffer. I was a think tanker and advocate. I love diving into those details. And the latter half of the book is a lot about the problems facing democracy and what we can do to actually fix them. And not fix them in some far-off vision of the future 20 or 30 years from now, but what legislation can we pass in 2021 that makes democracy actually reflect the will of the people? And that means, for instance, fixing the Senate so that it actually is more responsive to the people, to ensure Mitch McConnell, who's the current Senate Majority Leader, if he is Senate Minority Leader in 2021, he will still have a veto power over all legislation. And he is proudly calling himself the Grim Reaper of progressive legislation
because because of the filibuster.
Because of the filibuster. Right. So to break the gridlock, if we take the majority in the Senate, and we have that in 2021, you've got to break the gridlock and eliminate the filibuster. After you do that, a whole host of things are possible. You can make D.C. a state. You can give representation to Puerto Rico if they choose it. On the House side and on the voting side, you can expand the vote to millions of new people. You can ensure an election security. You can pass campaign finance laws. You can invest in public media, which is currently dying around this country. There are a whole host of things you can do legislatively. None of this is rocket science. The problem that we face right now is not that we don't have the good ideas. The good ideas are there. It's that the political will isn't there to make it happen. And that brings me, I think, to the second part of the solution, because part of this is, do we have the legislation we need to pass in 2021? And I think the answer is affirmatively yes. We have that, and the book goes over the pieces of legislation that we could pass. But the other side of the equation is, do we have the political will? And this is why it is so important to be developing this independent power in communities across the country. This is why Indivisible is building itself up now, because we know that it is not enough to celebrate on November 3rd of 2020 if in January of 2021, the newly elected Congress and the newly elected president, they don't move forward with the legislation we need. So what we want to see in 2021 is, yes, unified progressive control of Congress and the presidency. That is what we're building towards in 2020. But in 2021, we need Indivisible groups and other folks all over the country saying, great, we booted out Trump, and now we expect you to act to save our democracy.
So let's think about that particular issue in terms of the Democratic presidential candidates that are vying to get the nomination right now. Two questions here. Are the groups trying to push those candidates in certain directions that reflect the things that you've been talking about? And then secondly, ultimately, will you pick one to support on that basis before a winner kind of emerges after, let's say, the first five or six primaries?
Yeah. So absolutely the groups are pushing the presidential candidates on democracy issues as well as other issues. Our goal is not to have the presidential candidates all line up behind one specific piece of legislation or one specific platform. We want to see the presidential candidates try to out-democracy each other. Hmm. And we want to see them prioritize democracy reforms, because we want to see climate legislation. We want to see healthcare legislation. We want to see gun violence prevention legislation in 2021. And also, we know none of that is possible as long as we have a democracy that is held hostage by folks like Mitch McConnell or the folks that are currently supporting Donald Trump. In order to break that gridlock, in order to push through all of the social and economic reforms we want to see in 2021, we need a president who is saying, as soon as I take office, my first priority is reforming democratic institutions to make sure popular legislation can actually become law. So yes, we are actively pushing presidential candidates on that. National Indivisible is doing that. The local groups are actively asking the presidential candidates about that. That is a top priority now. And many of the candidates are coming out with actually bold platforms when it comes to this. I would say the filibuster has come up more in this discussion in this presidential primary than literally ever before in the history of the Republic. It's a wonky issue. It seems in the weeds. It doesn't seem like it should be something that we're focusing on. And yet people are diving into it because they understand unless you tackle these structural problems with American democracy, nothing else we're talking about matters. So The short version is, yes, we are pushing the presidential candidates on democracy. I expect more developments to come. And again, one of the reasons why we're putting out the book is to encourage that healthy debate about democracy issues.
But it doesn't sound like then Indivisible as an organization is going to say, we're backing Elizabeth Warren, say, before the Iowa caucuses.
So in the 2017-2018 cycle, Indivisible National did endorse in primaries. And we set up a very intentional process to do that. The way it worked, it started with the local groups and it had to end with the local groups. So if you were trying to endorse a congressional candidate, let's say a Yana Presley, who was running in a competitive primary in Massachusetts, you would first—
Or Dana Balter here.
Or Dana Balter here.
Yeah, right.
So you would have to first vote as a local group to endorse that candidate. Then you would nominate that candidate for a national endorsement. We would then send a questionnaire out and say, what are your policy positions? Are there any red flags? Do you commit to endorsing whoever wins in the primary? That's very important. There's no taking your ball and going home. Do you commit to rallying around whichever Democrat comes out of the primary? And if so, we would then put it out to a vote to the Indivisibles in that district. And if they got a supermajority, we would then issue a national endorsement. Now, that basic philosophy is how we are approaching the presidential, which is to say it doesn't particularly matter if Indivisible National chooses one particular candidate, a Booker or a Harris or a Warren or a Buttigieg. If the local group's on there, there's no power behind it. So I can't tell you whether for sure we're going to get to an endorsement or not. What I can say is we're currently talking with the Indivisible groups all over the country to gauge their interest. And if the Indivisible groups don't want to do it, we're not going to do it. And if the groups do want to do it, but there's not adequate support for a candidate, we're not going to do it. The way that we build this movement is by closely following the lead of the groups on the ground and not parachuting in and just trying to dictate where the movement's going to go.
We don't have enough time in the broadcast portion to talk about the elephant in the room that we haven't gotten to, which is impeachment. We'll do that in an extra web portion of this interview. But we've just got really literally a few seconds now. Let me just ask you if you could very quickly, complicated question perhaps, but in this idea of changing the filibuster, do you worry, though, that that might come back to haunt you down the road if there's a reaction such as there was in 2010 and then, you know, all that stuff gets erased?
So I think there's nothing standing—
20 seconds or less.
Yeah. I think Mitch McConnell will do away with the legislative filibuster as soon as it is a problem for him. So I don't think we should be preventing ourselves from passing country-saving legislation because we're worried about what some theoretical future Republican majority is going to do. And fundamentally, the question isn't what is the problem that you're going to face in the future. It's do you want to pass legislation in 2021 or don't you? That's the problem that we're confronting. And if you want to get anything done, you got to eliminate the filibuster.
I'm Grant Reher, and I'm talking with Ezra Levin, the co-founder of the Indivisible Movement and co-author of a new book titled We Are Indivisible, A Blueprint for Democracy After Trump. One of the things, Ezra, that we didn't have time to speak about in the broadcast portion was this question of impeachment. It's a huge question. I understand you want to clarify something or follow up on something that you were talking about in the broadcast portion. Let's do that, and then we'll talk about impeachment.
Okay, great. Well, so I just wanted to circle back on the book. It's worth noting, so Leah, my spouse, and I were co-executive directors of Indivisible. We wrote this book by talking to members of Indivisible all over the country and by talking to policy experts and political scientists on the field of democracy reform. That said, 100% of the author proceeds are actually going to Indivisible Save Democracy Fund. We don't get a dime from the book, and that's intentional. This is not a book for Leah and Ezra. This is a book for the movement. So just wanted to make that clear that we are going to be pushing this book out with the sole goal of getting it in as many hands as possible so that we can grow the movement.
I'm glad you brought that up, because one of the things I also wanted to ask in the broadcast portion, but we just couldn't squeeze it in, was just some basics about the funding of your organization.
Yeah.
So tell me about that. Who are your funders?
Yep.
How does it break out? There was, I think, at one point a story that I believe was false about that, you know, you were basically an arm of George Soros.
Yeah,
so
yeah, yeah.
Tell us about the funding.
We got questions from George Soros early on. It almost became an inside joke of the movement where we had Indivisible group leaders showing up with signs that said, hey, George, where's my check?
Okay.
There was a right-wing news operation that when we were still, you know, our main expense was pizza for volunteers and we were working out of our living room that said, well, Ezra Levin must be an arm of Soros because he worked for a nonprofit that had a board member who once had a fellowship that was partially paid for by Soros.
Okay.
So we've been fielding those from early on. We cover this in the book. I was speaking at a conference, a progressive conference at some point, and somebody from the Open Society Foundation came up to me after I spoke and introduced himself. And he said, "Hey, I thought I should just introduce myself to you because it turns out we're funding everything you do, apparently." We started out building the organization, and we put a donate button on the website. That was literally it. Leah and I drafted this really apologetic email to people who had signed up saying, "I know this is distasteful, but if you could spare a few dollars, that would be great." And we raised about $100,000 off of that email that went out within a couple-day period. To this day, grassroots funding, which is just money that comes in from emails or from the website or from social media, is our single largest source of funds. We have a pretty
What percent would that be?
This year, it's probably around 40%. Yeah, around 40%, 40%. Especially this year, and to some extent last year, foundations have started coming through. So OSF, Open Society Foundation, did start supporting us. Other foundations started supporting us as well. And then also major gifts, which we would define as $2,500 or more just from individuals, have started coming in as well. So we have a few bright lines around how we accept funds. And the goal of all of this is to stay as beholden to the movement as possible while also not treating the people on our email list like an ATM. Nobody wants to get emails every day saying, "The house is on fire, give us money, give us money." And we really try to actively shy away from that. So we don't take any money from political figures. So if you were an elected official running for office, we don't take money. That's important so we can be independent. We don't take money, obviously, from corporations and never have. And we don't take more than 20% of our funding from, and it's actually lower than that, from any individual source. And so, again, the goal is to have
Except for the grassroots, thought of as a whole.
Exactly. Intentional. That's intentional. So that this is our goal, to have diversified funding to allow us to grow as we need to, but also not be beholden to any individual source. And so we're committed to that. We have been for the last 3 years. It's been an effective enough strategy that's allowed us to grow and have now organizers spread around the country supporting the Indivisible groups.
And again, just for the record then, are you getting any money from the Soros Foundation at this
Open
point?
Open Society Foundation, yes.
Yeah, okay.
So that's why I told that story earlier.
Okay.
Yes. And in fact, we went back and forth about it because we were worried about all the right-wing attacks. We were worried about the impact it would have on the movement. And so Leah and I wrote this probably 2,000 or 3,000 word blog post on, "Hey, we've gotten this offer from Open Society. We don't want to give in to the right-wing anti-Semitic attacks that are coming to us. And so we're going to take and we're proud, and we are proud. And if anything, we would be happy to take more money from the Open Society Foundation because we think they're funding a lot of good pro-democracy work." And
as long as it didn't get over 20%.
Right. Oh, yeah. That's right. And we're in no danger of that, but happy to have that problem.
Okay. So now, impeachment. I assume that you – well, let's find out. Do you support – And I need to remind our listeners, I may not have reminded them yet, we're talking on October 11th, and a lot of things obviously can change between now and when this program airs. But at least as of October 11th, do you support the Congress bringing articles of impeachment against the president?
Yes. So Indivisible was one of the first national organizations to come out strong in favor of impeachment proceedings nearly 2.5 years ago when Donald Trump went on national TV and said that he had fired the director of the FBI for investigating election interference. We came out in favor of impeachment proceedings. We thought that was quite reasonable, that was an impeachable offense. So yes, Indivisible nationally supports it. We recently did a poll of Indivisible groups on this, and the result was something above 95% of the Indivisible respondents actually said that they were in favor of impeachment. So we are strongly behind this. Indivisible groups have been showing up in blue districts, in red districts, in purple districts, asking their members of Congress to sign up in favor of impeachment proceedings for some time. There's been a spike of that activity, especially since the Mueller testimony. There was several months of more or less congressional inaction, where the Judiciary Committee wasn't moving forward, then it was trying to move forward, then leadership in the House was preventing it from moving forward. And our goal in that period was to get as many Democrats and Republicans, if we could get them, on board for impeachment proceedings. And so we had a whole impeachment August where we were running events all across the country trying to convince members to come out in favor. And then after Ukraine hit, we had another spike of activity.
So a tactical question regarding this. Do you have worries, though, that given where we are now on October 11th, given the likely amount of time this is all going to take, that the impeachment may distract your members from the work for the 2020 election, both in terms of the presidential election, but also the down ballot races, that it's just going to suck up all of the available oxygen in a way that may ultimately work to the president's advantage. And particularly if this impeachment process backfires politically, and some pundits think it might. So.
Yeah. Let me say two or three things in response to that. First of all, I just don't think we have a choice. Fundamentally, Donald Trump has committed impeachable crime after impeachable crime. When this airs 3 weeks from now, I'm sure we're going to have another dozen that we could have talked about. I don't think this is about Donald Trump anymore. This is about the actual functioning of our democracy in the long term. And so if we are going to keep this democracy, we have to identify the crimes he has committed as impeachable crimes. Otherwise, it's just going to encourage future wannabe dictators and probably wannabe dictators who are more competent than Donald Trump. So I think it is an urgent necessity for us to actually act on this. On the political question, I think there are a lot of political analysts who are playing three-dimensional chess who honestly just don't know what they're talking about. I think nobody knows the precise impact that impeachment is going to have, but I see it from the grassroots side. And I see right now grassroots activists who maybe haven't been as active before now standing up and becoming active. The people who built the blue wave in 2018, who fought to give Democrats control of the House of Representatives, did that in order to see oversight of this administration, in order to see this administration be held accountable. Now that's happening. If it doesn't happen, they're going to wonder why they spent all that time knocking on doors, sending texts, making calls to build the wave. The fact that the House is actually using the power that we put blood, sweat, and tears into giving them, that's going to energize the grassroots to build power for 2020. And then a more narrow but I think very important political point is, in addition to building up this grassroots energy, by impeaching the House of Representatives, we are helping the fight in the Senate. Because what we know is that if we get to an impeachment in the House, there will be a vote in the Senate. And we also know that there are Republicans in states like Maine and Arizona and Iowa and North Carolina and Georgia, in places where Trump is underwater and unpopular, and there are Republicans running for re-election in those states, and they're going to have to vote. They are actually going to have to take a stand and say, I am going to give the green light to this president because he is a Republican and allow him to get foreign powers to interfere in our elections. I'm going to put party above country. That's a choice I want them to have to make, because if they make that choice, I think we have a better chance to take their seats, and then we have a better chance to pass legislation in 2021.
Or Mitch McConnell may just not take it up, though. That's been floated, although he said he's going to have the vote.
I think it would be extremely damaging for Mitch McConnell not to take it up. And if he does not take it up, then I want to hear from Ernst. I want to hear from Susan Collins. I want to hear from Martha McSally. I want to hear from all of these senators whether they agree with that decision. Currently, they can't even answer the question, do you think a president should be able to interfere in our elections by getting a foreign power to do his dirty work? They can't answer the question. They're doing backflips. They're doing everything they can to avoid it. And that's going to continue for the foreseeable future.
Once again, that was Ezra Levin, and the book is called We Are Indivisible, A Blueprint for Democracy After Trump. Ezra, thanks for taking the extra time to talk with me.
Love talking.
The Campbell Conversations was hosted and produced by Grant Reher, engineered by Tom Fazio, and edited by Jason Smith. Associate producers include Sarah Forland and Zane Aga. The Campbell Conversations is a joint production of the Campbell Public Affairs Institute at Syracuse University and WRBO Public Media. To learn more about the program or to hear previous interviews, visit us online at wrvo.org/Campbell Conversations or download the show as a podcast from iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.